Welcome to the Swaplex Podcast. My name is Brandon Lede.
I'm Brittany Lombas.
I'm Hannah Rassinen.
And I am James Cohn.
And we are recording in Studio C, Brittany's apartment in Bayou St. John, New Orleans. And this is the podcast version of the movie review website,
Swaplex
Overlook Edition. This is our roundup of the Overlook Film Festival, which was in basically both locations of the Britannia, uptown and downtown, for 5 days on a beautiful early spring April. I spent the entire festival inside of a downtown shopping mall, not really talking to anybody unless they happened to see me in line.
Shrouded in darkness.
Because I watched 13 movies in 4 days.
Incredible.
Shameful, really. I mean, so there's almost too much stuff to talk about in this episode. I do have a guest later in this conversation, Bill Arsenault, who's kind of our regular festival correspondent. But I gathered you all here to talk about the two different film festival experiences. One is you get a pass and you wait in line an hour before every screening, nervous about whether you'll get in, just shivering with anticipation. Are they going to let me in the theater? And the other way is that you buy a ticket for one movie and you show up 5 minutes before it starts because you've been attending a basketball game. Nacho cheese still hot on your breath, casually strolling in.
But it was very stressful for me, though, because I was unclear about the actual process of how they let people in with priority given to pass holders or to ticket holders. So me and Hannah were reading the website and like, man, are they just going to like take my money and not let me into the movie? Like it was a little unclear, but then Hannah came a little earlier and got it cleared up.
Yeah.
I had a similar experience because like I just showed up. I was like, let me get this ticket. And then I saw a giant line. I was like, what? And then I'm like, I don't know what to do. And then I like saw like Brandon and Hannah in this other line. I was like, okay, I guess I'll go say hi. And then I like for some reason I'm like, dude, Brandon's probably been camped out here. And he's like trying to get in, and you're like, Brittany, that's not how it works. The giant line is the pass holders. They go in first, and then we wait. And I'm like, wait, what? How does that happen? And then they had this wonderful being that just floated in and was like, let me explain how this works. Okay, everyone's going to get refunded if you can't make it in the movie. And I don't know. I will say their crowd control was
incredible. Like,
yeah.
They opened theaters when stuff sold out. They've shuffled people around and they kept walking around communicating with everybody.
Yeah.
Like,
yes.
Managing expectations.
I learned so much.
That man, he had just the most calming energy. It was like he was soaking up all of the stress of the festival and then turning it into pure communication and good natured. Just banter before the film.
Beautiful hair.
And it was fantastic. Yeah, beautiful hair. I kind of wanted him in my life forever. He just made me feel better about everything that was happening.
I will say that was this year, like I was worried going in, like, man, like it says tickets are, it's like money is non-refundable. If I can't get in, well, they're just going to take my money. Like, oh, screw this festival, whatever. And then I got there. And the magical man made me feel better.
Right. And there was something so therapeutic about it.
It was all good.
Yeah.
Good vibes.
Yeah. Their website, it wasn't clear that if you buy a ticket, you may not be able to get into the movie, but also you will be refunded. And maybe it's because they didn't anticipate it being that big of a problem. But, you know, this year they were they made it very easy after the fact.
It was more crowded but less hectic, I think.
Yeah.
And that is our roundup on how they could clean up their online FAQ page.
Right.
How to fest.
Yeah. Very well organized, though, when you get there.
Yeah. And I would say super well curated, which is like the reason that you want to stand in line. Like, the program is always the best festival in the city. It's all horror movies, technically, but it is a wide range of different kinds of films. And it's usually half of my watch list of things I wanted to see this year anyway, just all play in a single location in a few days, which is great. Including the movie that we all saw together, which is called In a Violent Nature. It is a Canadian slasher. The director popped his head in very briefly before the screening and said, this is the most derivative original slasher film you've ever seen. Maybe I got that backwards. The most original derivative slasher film.
Yeah, that kept looping in my head as I was watching the movie. I think that really does capture a lot of what's going on in this film.
I'm going to try to describe the premise. It is like basically a throwback to the Michael Myers, Jason Voorhees sequels from the 80s, where there's just this killer who is buried in the woods, and there's this golden locket hanging above his makeshift unmarked grave, and some idiot teens who are spending the night camping and smoking weed and having premarital sex steal the locket, which awakens the unstoppable killing machine. He raises from the grave and just basically stalks them one by one and kills them. And they make idiotic banter that annoys the fuck out of you and you want to see them killed. So it's like kind of satisfying when they meet their end. The difference between the 80s stuff and this is just in how it's shot. It's kind of shot like a slow moving art house film. I want to call it slow cinema in the style of like Sleep Has Her House, where there is just like lingering shots of the woods without any dialogue for like minutes on end sometimes. And a lot of wordless shots of just this killer from behind stalking in the woods, slowly catching up to the next victim. You know, in those like Jason movies, someone will run away from him very fast and then he like gradually catches up and kills them anyway. You watch it happen in real time now. Like you follow him instead of the victim. So the movie's doing like two opposite things. Like in one side of it, it's giving you exactly what you want from those old school slashers where these really annoying characters are killed in this spectacular violence. It kind of goes overboard on the violence in a way that's very cartoonish. And it's like, you want to see blood? I will show you some gore you have never seen before in your life. And on the other hand, it's like super withholding and abstracts the rhythm of a slasher movie and turns it into a, like a slow moving art house film instead of like your typical like Friday night at the movies. I'll just see whatever horror movie's playing kind of stuff. How did that balance work for y'all? Because it's very strange.
Yeah, I don't know. I think that I appreciated it, but it did not totally work for me. Like so much of the character work was so corny. Like the acting wasn't particularly good. I don't think it was intended to be like really great dramatic acting.
I think it's bad on purpose.
Yeah.
But it's not so bad that it's entertaining.
It was like, really plain.
Like I've seen like horror movies where like the characters are obviously awful and they're so over the top with their awfulness. You're like, oh man, this is kind of funny and I can't wait to see them die. Like hanging out with these teens was just kind of boring and they're all douchey and just sort of suck. Like it's a different level. It's not quite that satirical bad.
I think even like beyond the teens too, like that initial argument that happens in the beginning where the killer kind of comes out of the grave in the woods and goes towards the road, there's this really like poorly acted argument that's kind of happening that's a little confusing. But like I don't know, like I couldn't figure out like do I not like this because of that or does that make this more interesting?
I found it accurate. Like, it didn't feel like an exaggerated satire of the 80s slasher movies. It just felt like watching one. This is exactly as poorly written and acted as, like, most Friday the 13th movies.
I think that the difference to me was in the visual style because it's so beautiful and remote and crisp. And it feels, the acting feels out of place and it feels worse to me. I think the really campy stylization of older movies kind of it creates a unique world that is a little bit hyper real, but this is like I'm looking at the real world and it's really stark, but these people aren't, I'm not,
they're
connecting
fake as fuck.
That makes sense of like why it felt so out of place, because I thought it was beautiful.
Yeah.
Like the shot, it's like an old Polaroid or something.
It's these really long, long shots where like I appreciated that and it really held my attention even though like it was at a slow pace. And then like there were so many payoffs too of like there's this constant dread where I'm like, okay, someone's going to get like their guts ripped out their asshole in any second. But I know it's going to take a long time to get there, but it's going to happen and it's going to be fabulous. So I kind of like that anticipation and that like long awaiting of like walking behind that like nasty little bald head of the killer and waiting for him to do that.
Yeah, it was, I liked the slow cinema aspects of it. Yeah. And I like that vantage point of just like his perspective, not the teen that's trying to run away. It's just like him methodically working his way towards his next kill.
Just
like
wants
that
the
was,
necklace, you know?
That was extremely effective. I think where it, for me, kind of loses its way is you have that kind of tone. You have the annoying teens who have to be annoying. And then you have these grotesque, over-the-top kills. You know, it's like kind of jarring to go from slow cinema to annoying teen hangout to getting your guts ripped out your asshole. Like, that's a lot of different tonal, like a tonal palette to try to do. And I don't know if it does it successfully, but I commend it for trying, you know. I wasn't actually that bored with it. I
wasn't bored at all. I was a little tired. It was my fourth movie that day.
Well, yeah. But, and it was really late,
too. Yeah, it was like it ended at around midnight.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
And I went to like a basketball game before. Like, I should have been more bored, but I wasn't.
Yeah. I really liked the killer. I was sympathetic towards him. I think he was brutal. I liked that unrelenting nature. I know that's very similar to the Halloween films. I really loved the setting. I love, you know, forest wilderness. It was really beautiful. I just thought this was a not necessarily a super unique killer, but a different flavor on something that I've seen before that I was very compelled by.
They did give him cool tools for violence.
Yeah, like, the wood, that claw. Like hook.
Yeah, like part of his thing. Backstory was that he was killed in a prank that involved like vintage or antique fireman equipment.
Yeah.
So like his tools for killing are like a fireman's axe. He obscures his hideous face with this old fireman's mask, quote unquote. Yes. But it's like this kind of like almost looks like the isolation helmet from like deep sea diving.
It's so cool.
It's like that and a gas mask mixed together. Yeah.
And then
it's
also so he has the most unique thing is a drag hook.
Yeah.
Which is, I guess, used for dragging lumber around the woods because it's kind of like a lumbering community. And yeah, it's fucking disgusting what he does with it.
Probably that kill, the yoga kill, was probably the sickest kill I've seen in a horror movie. And I can't remember, a couple years at least.
It's so weird. Like, I can't get over that extreme end of like delivering just the goods that like,
right.
Yeah, that kill is fucking disgusting. It's super memorable. It is like, I've been wanting to see something like that in a slasher for so long. And on the other end, like making someone who would want to see that stare at the woods for 3 minutes. Like I find that the fact that it does both of those things super interesting. I don't know. I was actually like really enthusiastic about this.
Those were the two elements that I liked. And then I didn't care for the, I don't know, I guess I don't necessarily know how they could have done the characterization differently, but I was really into the gore. I was really into just staring at the woods,
just not the people.
Yeah
They were like the least, I think, important thing in this. Like,
yeah,
what this did is like you get these like disgusting demented kills, and then when you're like sort of, here's a shot where you're looking in the woods the whole freaking time, I'm like, this dude is behind you, he's on the side, and or he's in the front of you, and it's like that anxiety of this like killer, and the more you have to like stare at this like empty field or this like empty set of trees, I'm like, it just kept getting like more and more intense like in my mind.
Yeah, the scene where he's like kind of stalking around the house.
Yes.
And you just see him kind of maybe picking his next target, but then going to a different target instead. You know, a lot of films I think would switch perspective of, now we're looking at it from the killer's eyes, and now we're in the house with the kids and we can see the killer outside. Like, all from his perspective made it so creepy, because you're like, man, there might be some dude in the woods that's just like looking at me like that.
And it's framed like a video game, like you're playing him as a character, right? Yeah. Like it's like slightly ahead of your point of view.
That's exactly, that is exactly what I thought about the dialogue, too.
Yes.
There's a scene where there are lots of scenes where he's walking towards people and they're talking and you hear them getting louder as he's approaching them. And it's very similar to playing a stealth video game where those people are totally unaware of what you're doing and they're providing some exposition and a little bit of information about their dynamics, but you as a character have a completely different goal. It was very interesting.
You know what movie does a very similar balance like this is Beyond the Black Rainbow, where most of the film is this like slow moving glacial, like fucking gorgeous art piece. And it's like just very strange and psychedelic. And then the killer who's been like created in this psychedelic environment escapes and goes into the woods. And there's these very annoying NPC characters around a campfire. And it turns into like a cheesy slasher very abruptly towards the end, and people hate that scene because it's like such a strange shift for the movie, but this movie like does that the whole time.
Yeah,
like it's like that one scene from Beyond the Black Rainbow like turned into its own concept. But I always enjoyed that scene in Beyond the Black Rainbow, and I kind of enjoyed the jarring tonal shift of that a lot.
Yeah, I feel like it took a risk in that you could go one way of just like full slow cinema. Like, it's all that slow nature stuff, his perspective. And I might have enjoyed that. Or you go the full crowd pleaser gore fest. And you know that's going to, like, get you buzz. But it kind of, like, shoots it straight down the middle.
It's a strange choice.
It's a, it's a difficult way to navigate it. I maybe like Beyond the Black Rainbow a little bit more.
Me too, yeah.
Than this, but... Again, I do appreciate the effort. Me personally, like, I would like to have seen a version of it that was all slow cinema. Just because I'm a fan of that style. And that's what
the trailer says. The trailer doesn't show any of that cheese.
And that's why I was excited to go see it. But I also was taken aback, like, oh, there are fun kills here. And this is, like, a little more exciting. But I would have liked to really just sit in that dread.
Yeah. I was convinced that I was going to be terrified by this movie, and I really wasn't up until maybe the last 20 minutes. And they're not terrifying. It just ramps up the intensity, and you do feel for one character in particular more than you felt for other people that are getting killed or chased. But for instance, there's one scene in the very beginning that totally turned me off, which is he's walking through a house and he's trying to get this locket back. He sees a golden necklace hanging in a mirror, and then the mirror transforms into a flashback that with his father cheesy. And his father saying, no, if you have this necklace, you'll always be with your or something like that. Always be with your mother. And I hated that.
It's so accurate though. Like, I just saw Jason Takes Manhattan, which is my favorite Friday the 13th
that one's
movie.
Great.
And yeah, and that one's on a cruise ship. It's not in Manhattan for like 90% of it. But in the cruise ship, Jason keeps seeing flashbacks. Every time he looks in a mirror or in like one of the port windows on the ship, he keeps seeing flashbacks to his childhood and to like earlier stuff that happened to him where he's like re-traumatized by the memories of how he died as a child. And it just felt so accurate.
Well, I guess then incorporating that is a part of the derivative, but it didn't make any sense to me with the tone of the film.
Right.
I didn't have that context, and I thought this is stupid.
But like, I had
it is stupid to be clear.
But I had a coworker who had saw the trailer, and I told him I was going to see it, and he asked me after. It was like, so it seems like it's just kind of like a A24 Jason, and like, yeah, that's
kind
of
yeah,
that's totally the vibe of like. With the mommy issues and those weird, like, kind of flashback stuff, and even like his sort of physical appearance, and it was very Jason to me, mixed with like the A24 kind of style. I don't think that was like off the mark.
I think this movie assumes that you've seen too many slashers before. You intrinsically know this genre, and you know all its tropes. It's going to show you all those things you're already familiar with, just from a slightly weird angle that doesn't change any of that stuff. It doesn't like re-examine it or recontextualize it. It just like takes a weird approach to it that just makes it feel off. And there's just something really like bizarre about its presentation.
Yeah, I guess ultimately I was hoping for, you know, like we've talked a lot about some modern like Skinamarink or movies that sort of like push the boundaries of the genre and like, I thought this was going to be the slow cinema slasher. And it
does that.
It does for like But then it hedges its bet. It like has to go with the like satisfying gross kills. For me, if it would have went total devotion to a new kind of slasher that's all slow, methodical, art house cinema, I would have liked it more. And I do think that's what the trailer promises. At least it did to me and what got me excited. I think the like final picture is like a little muddled in tone. But again, I'm not knocking it completely. I thought it was a very interesting watch.
I was specifically remembering last year when you like said that, you know, Outwaters and Skinamarink had kind of changed the horror game. Why is that not reflected in like the Overlook program? And I was like, well, you know, that stuff just came out. Give it a year or two and mm-hmm. it might be like influenced by you that new wave. And I think that's what this is. Like it that slow cinema sensibility has crept into horror festival programming. Like they might have been making movies like this 2 years ago, but they're more likely to make it onto a festival mm-hmm. program now than they used to be.
But you also still need to have like the gross out kills to keep I'm the not fans mad at happy.
It. Makes it spicy.
Yeah, no, and I like that stuff too. I do. I just it didn't quite I don't think it was pushing.
I liked
the boundaries.
How like confused it made me feel. Like there was something about that where I'm like, I think this is successful, where there's this like slow ASMR bizarre way of filming a killer, and then all of a sudden we see like the most bad shit murders that like I've seen in a movie in a very long time. Yeah. It reminded me of like all the weird Fangoria movies I used to watch when I was in high school that were just like focused on gore.
Yeah.
But like just it's peppered in very tastefully.
It kind of delivered everything I want out of a horror movie. There were like parts that were really tense.
Yeah.
And then there were parts that were so gruesome. The only response to it was to laugh because it was so excessively violent.
What I would have liked is if there were no plot. If there was no plot. Almost.
I mean, there barely is. Like, this guy wants a necklace back. That's right. About it.
Like, but why even mention the necklace? Like, why mention the mother and the flashbacks? It doesn't matter.
Or what
like,
if he just would have walked through the woods and started finding people and killing them? Like, we didn't need to know they were all friends in this, like, house.
And that's
like,
what Halloween does so well.
Right. Like, we don't know who half the people are that he starts to, like, approach
just, like,
on Halloween.
The
thing...
anonymous person that kills people.
And then 40 years of Halloween sequels have kind of undone that work.
Yes. Yeah.
Right.
You know, I think this is getting at something that is unique and very fun and gruesome and scary and interesting. I think it didn't quite get there for me. There's just something that the gears just kind of clashed a little bit too much. But I think this was a directorial debut,
yes.
Right? I would be very excited to see this guy make more films.
Yeah.
I agree with that.
And 100%. I think if this movie was directed by like Quentin Depew, I feel like that would get to the place where it's like, yes, this is a perfect movie for me. Just a little bit of molding of the comedy a little bit. But I think this is a good direction for horror to go in general.
Spooky season is upon us, and New Orleans is rich in haunted history, making the Crescent City a Halloween hotspot. For haunted history tours, Halloweekend is one of the busiest of the year. The French Quarter Ghost and Legends Tour is most popular, but there's also the Vampire, True Crime, Voodoo, Cemetery, and Haunted Pub Crawl Tours.
New Orleans is generally considered to be the most haunted city in the country. The original French settlers were warned by the Indians not to build a city here, that the area was cursed, and they didn't listen. They built a city here anyway, and they had to deal with everything from yellow fever to murders. The murder rate was high, hurricanes, cannibalism.
And for the second half of this conversation, I am joined by local film critic Bill Arsenault.
Hey, guys. Hey, Brandon.
Hey.
It's great to be here again.
Yes, this is both an intimate conversation and consumable for the public if they wish.
I mean, I don't know how intimate we want to get here, but we typically do go pretty deep on movies. So, I mean, you know.
We've known each other a long time at this point.
I don't think we may have met once in person. for like some screening at Elmwood, I think.
Yeah, middle of the day. It was Unfriended to the Dark Web. And for two antisocial people who would rather disappear into the movies than like chat in public, it was one of those situations where we were pretty much the only people in that theater, so we had no choice but to talk and acknowledge each other.
That's the funny thing about those press screenings or just preview screenings in general is no one wants to talk to each other when they're sitting down. You know, it's always very awkward. I used to attend press screenings with when New Orleans had a bunch of critics, or not a bunch, more like a little more than a handful, you know, from Where You At Magazine, WWL, you know, stuff like that. And we would just be sitting there in the dark, not talking to each other, just sitting there waiting for the movie to start. And I was like, is this how it always goes?
It's not surprising for a hobby that like the main attraction is sitting in the dark and no one's allowed to talk to you, that it would attract a certain type of person that's not very socially lubricated, you know?
I always felt that during the commercials, you know, not the trailers, but the commercial part.
Yeah, you should chat.
You could chat a little bit. Or back when I was a kid, we didn't have the commercials. We just had the blank screen and maybe the radio was on the loudspeaker. And then they would do the intro for the movie and then the trailers, which I preferred, you know, but now everything's, you know, you gotta have commercials and everything, you know, pre-show roll and all that. But yeah, we would have conversations, and with the critics, not so much. But now it's just me and Mike Scott here on the North Shore doing holding it down for press screenings whenever they happen, few and far between. And we do talk during them. We even talked to the very kind publicist. And that was a surprise that we have a very kind one, because we used to have a very mean one. But yeah, no, we for Unfriended too. We chatted a bit and we had a good time, I think. The movie was okay. It was what it was.
I prefer the first one, and I think that's become more of a hot take. I think a lot of people think the second one's like
the first one was
more reasonable.
Yeah. Like it was what, supernatural? It had a ghost or something? And
yeah, that's why it's a better movie to me, is that they're not like faking it.
Yeah, it had the funniest straight ending to it. It was like she's like pulling up all these photos. Hey, we're best friends. Don't you remember all the good times? And the ghost is like, I'm gonna kill you anyways. What's the point, you know? And I thought that was hilarious.
Well, speaking of official film criticism and you know, going to press screenings and all that.
Yeah.
Where are you covering Overlook right now? Like, where can people look for posts reviewing films at the festival?
I haven't yet posted. I've been kind of sitting on my hands. About it, taking care of a couple of other assignments first, but I have all my notes down. They're gonna come up on moviegoing.rocks, which is Movie Going with Bill. You can also get to it at moviegoing.substack.com. It's a Substack newsletter and blog. And right now there are some reviews for a few documentaries at this point. Those are the most recent ones. I will have The People's Joker on there this weekend, which is now playing at Zeitgeist in New Orleans. Well, the Araby area of New Orleans. And I should have Challengers on there pretty soon, too. But it'll be next week when the Overlook coverage is going to hit. And I think everyone or whoever reads my stuff will enjoy it. This year had a pretty good selection. I think Overlook is a very good festival for the area and a very good festival in general. I'm always surprised by the national critics or the other critics that come to town just to watch these movies and review them, which to me speaks volumes for just what this festival and this organization are able to pull together, you know, attention wise, recognition wise. You know, they're really growing into their own, I think.
It does seem less localized than New Orleans Film Fest proper, but I will say that they've done a good job of integrating themselves into that local infrastructure, and a lot of the same people who work for New Orleans Film Society who throw on the other two fests, the other two big ones, New Orleans Film Fest and French Film Fest, are working this festival as well. It seems like, you know, even though there are a lot of outside coverage, like a lot of outside press and filmmakers coming to town for it, more so than you'll see like the usual film nerds that you see at every other screening around town. It still feels like a local production because it's so, you know, tied up with New Orleans Film Society. Which I appreciate.
They've made a great effort to tune into the local community and make the effort to educate themselves. They've been here for like, what, 5, 6, 7 years, something like that?
Yeah, it's been a good while.
It's been a nice while. And so that I think they've at this point fully integrated as much as they can into what venues to use, what venues are already set up for movies. I think for a while they were showing stuff in the French Quarter itself, out of like a music venue or something, and or a multidisciplinary venue. And they tend to do pretty, they used to anyways, experimental stuff. I think they still are, but they're trying it in different ways, like the scare rooms or the scare mystery stories, live role play stuff they're doing. I don't know. I've never done that experience, you know, that they have. And they had, what's his face? From David, I can't pronounce his
last name. Das Melchin?
Yeah, he does a character, like a monster movie introduction character, movie host type thing at these screenings. I think he did it for Creature from the Black Lagoon 3D this year.
Yeah, I didn't go to that, but that movie is gorgeous in 3D. I remember when it played at Chalmette Movies, it was like mind-blowing.
Yeah,
underwater photography particularly.
I really wanted to go to that one. I unfortunately couldn't make it to that particular screening, but I've heard nothing but good things about that particular one. And I'm always excited about Overlook every year in New Orleans. I remember we had our own horror film festival that was set up by a local filmmaking troupe of crew people who were, you know, into special effects and stuff. It was the NOLA Horror Film Festival, and they tried expanding to Baton Rouge, but I think soon after they ended up going their separate ways and canceling the whole thing. But I'm glad we have our own horror film fest. That's kind of becoming a bigger film fest than expected.
Speaking of which, one of the big premiere screenings, it was like a very late edition of the program, was
very late. Yeah,
I think it was the second screening ever outside its premiere in Austin. It was Don Hertzfeldt's new movie, Me, which is about a 20-minute short animated film.
Yeah.
I guess the reason I wanted to bring it up first is because you usually come in here with short film selections that I just don't make time for in my schedule, to my shame.
Well, that's okay. That's all right. I mean, you know, I think critics tend to put off some short films, tend to go, okay, I got to prioritize. I got to, you know, make sure the big features or even to get a couple smaller features in. And then the short selections are kind of left to the average moviegoers who might spill in with a beer or two, you know, not really know, oh, I thought this was another movie, you know, but I tend to go for those. That's where you find the really, really messed up stuff or the really good experimental stuff or the up and comers, you know?
Yeah. It's like people whose names you'll see, headlining feature length productions in a few years later.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. But me, you know, Don Hertzfeldt, I've been following this guy for a couple of years now. I think since the mid 2010s, when I first heard of World of Tomorrow, and what was his other production?
It's
Such a Beautiful Day. That was the heartbreaking kicker. Yeah, that was the kicker.
I think Rejected was his big claim to fame. That was like early internet humor. It's a collection of cartoons he ostensibly made as advertisements that were all rejected because they were deranged humor that that was obviously not made for the actual commercials. It's like he like took the pitch as an excuse to like play with his little stick figures and make grotesque jokes at the company's expense.
That's funny.
And then it turned into like a early meme, like before social media. It was the kind of thing you would pass around on the internet as like, you got to see this.
Right. Yeah. Now Don is quite the singular talent there. And when I heard it was a musical that was going to be showed and at a horror film festival, you know, like what's the angle here? You know, it was almost like a hush hush kind of thing, you know, but he's going to be there too. You know, it reminded me of when, goodness, what was the film festival? I think it was Overlook, several years ago when they played Ari Aster's Hereditary. And that was also kind of, like a late edition, if I remember correctly. And Ari was also there. I can also remember the New Orleans Film Festival several years ago showing a Charlie Kaufman movie called Anomalisa, which no one knew anything about. It was like, here's a secret movie from Charlie Kaufman. And we go in there, and it's stop motion animation, and I'm like, oh, like it was a real shocker. So I'm interested to hear what you have to say about Me, because there was nothing else online about it other than a poster that said Me.
Well, speaking of Ari Aster, Hertzfeld is actually working with him on a bigger project.
Yeah, I read about that. Yeah.
And apparently it's been like a struggle because it's this huge production. And this animator who, I mean, if you've seen his work, it's very like hand-drawn stick figure style. And he usually works by himself, which takes a long time. You know, he's animating every cell by hand. But also working with other artists has proven to be equally frustrating for him. Like the Ari Aster project is eating up a lot of his time and it's taking years to develop. And likewise, Me was it started as a collaboration with a band that has not been named, but the rumor is that it was Arcade Fire. And
yeah, I heard about that. Yeah.
Once they got like soft canceled, the music had to change.
What was the controversy? I read about that, but I didn't read
the lead singer apparently is very like icky when it comes to like consent and like younger women.
Oh, jeez.
I think around the time they actually moved the band to New Orleans, a lot of that behavior started getting like online call outs. But that did not come up at the screening.
That's crazy that it was New Orleans that kind of brought that out a little bit, but that's sad, you know, very sad and very awful.
Let's say allegedly, just so we don't get sued for libel.
Oh, allegedly, yeah.
That's
yeah.
A okay. Internet hearsay that I'm repeating.
If true, yeah, but also bad for Don Hertzfeld because he was probably working on this project with a lot of effort, as I would imagine, and enthusiasm.
Well, it's probably better for the project that, you know, if it was them or if it was any band, that like that specificity was removed from it and it wasn't just a music video supporting someone else's work. Instead, the soundtrack has been replaced with pre-existing music. I specifically remember opening with like very frantic jazz and then closing with this very operatic kind of aria that's a lot calmer and more like beautiful. It is his stick figure style. Okay. The characters are a little more round, but they're still like hand-drawn line drawings. They look like kind of like if a bean had arms and legs.
Okay.
And sort of the plot of it, and like you said, there's no spoken dialogue really. It's all music. The kind of plot of it is there's this character who is having their life overrun by this invention. Like it's a male figure who fathers a child, and instead of like actively raising his baby with his partner, he gets distracted by this like idea he has that's like represented by this little bowl. And the more he works on the idea, it turns into this invention that like takes over the world. Like it becomes this big hit. But there's this sort of tragedy to it where by focusing on the invention, he loses track of like real life and like interacting with other people. And the experience of watching that made me very emotional in a way I did not expect. There's a lot of humor in it. And, you know, at times I was on the verge of tears while a lot of the audience was laughing. And I was like, well, you know, both of those responses are super valid because this is funny, but like,
but it can evoke. Yeah.
Yeah. I was thinking a lot about him particularly working alone in animation and like how isolating that kind of work is. So like this character working on this invention is sort of an extension of his isolating work that he does in real life. And then the background of all this, like, you know, selfish focus on an individual project is set against COVID in particular. There's a lot of other characters wearing masks as the inventor is sort of like pacing back and forth from his house to, you know, get groceries or whatever. And the reality of COVID in particular gets very grim in a way that like I'm not sure I've ever seen it acknowledged just how awful that time was in this specific way, where not only are, you know, characters wearing masks and isolating, but also there are police brutality scenes where the police are just beating the shit out of citizens while, you know, more privileged characters like our inventor are just kind of ignoring it and going about their day and fixating on their projects. Right. And then, you know, towards the end of the COVID section, There's just these mass graves of bodies being dumped, both from the illness and from the police brutality. So yeah, I think with The World of Tomorrow, he started doing this more layered digital style of his work where there's like kind of more color, still photographs, just strange intrusions beyond where he started with Rejected, where it's literally just stick figures and maybe a splash of red. But the emotional effect of this has really built to this like crescendo where I was kind of holding my breath for the entire 20 minutes on the verge of tears. And then it all releases at the end with this sort of operatic aria and all these people who are ignoring each other and looking at their phones and working on their little art projects and things are all connected by their smartphones to this giant wiring system. And then finally the movie just lets all of that go for this like kind of emotional open-ended note at the end. And yeah, it just really worked. I mean, he's like a genius and he's been called such.
Right. Oh, Don, not the inventor, but Don.
Yeah, yeah, Don. I mean, it's hard not to read the characters in Avatar for him too. But
Sure.
You know, I've heard him called like a genius before. I've never seen one of his movies in a theater before, so it was a little more involving than just kind of watching it on my laptop. But also, I've never seen a picture of him or anything, so it's just weird being in a room with him. And then immediately after, I saw him eating a burger at the Shake Shack, where I was eating my lunch between screenings as well. And it was just like, you know, he's just a guy. So, you know.
That's usually what these guys are. They're just guys, typically. Yeah. Well, except for David Lynch. I mean, like, he'll do normal things, but he'll talk about them in very... I don't know how to put it.
like wry, detached.
Detached and exaggerated manner. You know, yeah. Like, I'm eating a cookie and having a Coke. Wow. You know, something like that, yeah.
You can literally read the weather report and everyone's hanging off of every word.
Right. He's probably the only one that I would say is a little off, but in terms of a guy's guy or just a regular dude, you know. But yeah, you'd be surprised. A lot of these people, you know, Steven Soderbergh was at the Britannia for a screening of his epic Shay. And I remember my friend went up to him to ask for an autograph. He just gave him an autograph. Like he was, yeah, sure, buddy. It was just a dude, you know, he was just, you know, hanging around, making a business call, you know. Oh, okay, I'll sign this for you. Yeah, whatever.
A Baton Rouge guy specifically.
Yeah. But what you were describing with me reminded me of, I was talking about Charlie Kaufman a little bit earlier. It reminded me of Charlie's feature film with Philip Seymour Hoffman, Synecdoche, New York. I think that's how you pronounce it. I think that's part of the joke is that no one knows how to pronounce it. but in that film, it's about a theater director who's given a massive grant. I believe it's one of those... What do they call it? The one they give for people who are like genius?
The genius grant.
Genius grant, yeah.
Is it and MacArthur or something like that?
MacArthur, yeah. And he's also got this illness where he's not really quite sure what's reality or what's fiction, nonfiction, that kind of thing. His perceptions are going to be off. And slowly but surely, his project balloons into something bigger that he could have ever... or anyone could have ever intended. Like he builds this stage in a warehouse that kind of grows within the warehouse in a manner that is impossible. You know, the scale of it becomes like a full-blown city, if not a state. I think it's just a massive city with a metro area.
It becomes like a fake artificial version of his life that he's living in instead of his real life.
Right, and part of it is too is that his ex-wife is also doing art projects, but she's going more microcosmo. You know, she's going more inward, and he's going more outward. But that also is kind of a like he's an avatar for Charlie Kaufman as well. And I can see a lot of similarities between that movie and Me, not just on that level, but it sounds like that there's some bleed over, although I'm sure this one from Don Hertzfeldt has its own, you know, special specific quality and uniqueness that's directed from him.
Yeah, his visual style is, you know, uniquely his own. If anybody tried to do what he does, it would instantly read as like, you know, an homage, to put it kindly. But it is like very specific to him, and it is very like labor intensive. And just hearing him talk about like how long it takes for him to complete a project, how much like work goes into it, and then specifically this movie had to be redone to new music after it was like partially complete, like really heartbreaking stuff, to be honest, like to think about going back into the lab and like starting over on something that you've already thought out and like didn't a lot of the labor for. And I think that's like kind of reflected in the meat of the piece too, like the themes of it. So it's a very interesting work from a filmmaker who doesn't put out a lot, but every time he does, it's an event.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what I was really happy about, was this was an event screening that was happening. And I was just very happy that, Overlook was able to bring it.
I have plenty more I could talk about. I saw 13 screenings total, which is too much. I'm not going to cover it all, but I'm going to let you take the wheel for a while and tell me what you got to watch from the festival.
Well, I watched plenty of shorts. Here I'm going to kind of spotlight four films, two features and two shorts. And I guess I'll start with the shorts. The first one is called Dream Factory. This was directed by Alex Matraxia, and according to Letterboxd and according to what I watched, but I'm going to read the synopsis, it's an experimental short that explores the historical role of cinemas as cruising sites. People in the audience aren't familiar with that word, it's cruising is a term for gay men picking up each other for, you know, at different locations and going off to. I'm very shy about these kind of words.
So. It was a pre-grinder way of like hooking up for public sex.
Oh man, I could have just said that. It's kind of like if you've ever seen Goodbye Dragon Inn. There's a big influence from that movie onto this movie. Goodbye Dragon Inn was about the last night of a movie theater in somewhere in Asia. I think it was Taiwan. But Goodbye Dragon Inn, it's about the last night of a movie theater, and they're showing the classic martial arts movie Dragon Inn. And in the movie, there's a character who is trying to pick up different people. You know, he's essentially cruising. Just a young man in there, although his motivation appears to be money, not necessarily, you know, hooking up for the fun of it. And he tries his hand here and there. No, he doesn't really get any takers, but he does appear to learn a few things about the people that stalk around the theater, you know, the strangers, the ghosts, so to speak, the phantoms of the theater. It's not a haunted movie, but there are, you know, aspects to it that are haunting as an act by themselves. Dream Factory is very experimental in that there's no, from what I recall, there's no spoken dialogue. It's basically flashes of images, moving images, where you see like a projector light, right? And then you don't really see much of what's being projected. You don't really even see the screen. You just see like the frames running through the machine. And then you'll see the two guys sitting in their theater seats sharing cigarettes. You know, one is trying to smoke, the other one pulls out a lighter, tries to flick at it, you know, that kind of thing. They're sharing a bit of a connection there, but they're clearly, it clearly means something else, you know, like you see their hands, you see a lot of that, you see them kind of slowly bringing them together, but the film is very fast, you know, in the way it's cut. We see a character that I think is supposed to be kind of a variation on Humphrey Bogart. He's got the, you know, the coat, the hat, you know, almost kind of like he's straight from Casablanca. And he's kind of skulking around the lobby of the theater as well. It's a very interesting movie. I think it's got a lot of depth and meaning that I'm still trying to penetrate and pierce through, so to speak, you know. I love it when movies can challenge me, especially movies that are set in movie theaters. I am a sucker for those kind of movies that have that as a setting. When Kevin Smith's next movie comes out, which is set in his movie theater, that's an easy way to make a movie, right? Yeah, you own the building that you're going to shoot in. I'm going to go see it, and I'll probably love it at the very least for the environment. Maybe I'll hate it for other reasons, but who knows? But Dream Factory, you know, it's got something to it that's, I think it's the experimental aspect of it where it's just flashes of things happening. You know, it's, if anyone out there has seen The Outwaters, the really freaky horror film, found footage movie, that is extremely experimental of that particular genre. And I think is kind of by itself a very underrated gem.
Yeah. It's kind of like a slow cinema horror until it's not.
Yeah.
It's just like full on freak out in the last 40 minutes.
I'm like, what the hell's going on?
Yeah.
It becomes like an H.P. Lovecraft nightmare kind of out in the desert. But there, in that movie, there are scenes where it looks like it's shot through a flashlight, you know,
yeah.
or like the lens is very far away and very small. And all we can see are little glimpses at people or dirt or something. And we have to kind of use that to create logic in our head. It's almost like that, but this one makes more sense in those moments because the screen is bigger. You know, we see the more of the images, and it's primarily those two young men watching a movie, smoking, and making subtle gestures toward one another that kind of speak volumes about what may or may not happen after the movie's over, you know, after the showtime has concluded and they're probably leaving the place or going into the bathroom or something.
It sounds like early Kenneth Anger shorts, like when he was doing his gay cruising shorts before he was doing his Anton LaVey Satanist, you know, rituals towards the end of his career.
Didn't Kenneth Anger say something along the lines of cinema is an evil force?
Well, if anyone's cinema lives up to that, his later films definitely do.
Okay, yeah. I think there's something to that quote, but I don't know if I would call it. Someone on Blue Sky, the social media network, was like wanting people to list movies that they felt were evil. What movies do you think are evil? And I wrote back, I really don't think any movie is evil, but here's a few that I think might come close to what you're talking about.
Yeah.
You know, and I kind of wrote a little description next to them, like not flat out evil, but definitely it's got demented views. You know, I suppose people would bring up Salo, the 120 Days of Sodom, but I would completely disagree with that. I don't think
it's a movie about evil.
It's a movie about evil, but it's not evil itself. A Serbian film comes extremely close to that, but I think it's way too pretentious and up its own ass to have that kind of level of demonic possession or whatever you want to call it, evil intentions. I don't know. You know, someone brought up In a Glass Cage. I think that one is a good choice, but again, I don't. That's irrelevant. I don't even really think cinema is evil. There might be something to that quote though from Kenneth Anger. I don't know.
He was a great shit poster. Maybe the very first.
Indeed. The second short film that I want to spotlight is kind of a toss-up, actually. I brought this up before the recording. I wasn't sure which one to cover, but I wanted to cover one of the two. So maybe I'll just cover both. The first one is Hypoxia. I did not give this one a good star rating. I kind of gave it like a under middle of the road, like two out of five stars. But I did want to bring it up because it's got beautiful photography. And that goes a long way with me. It's about a older African-American gentleman who is having like this big monologue poolside on some like skyscraper maybe or some apartment complex in a city. And he's talking about his life and how, you know, we work to ourselves to death and for what, you know, for capitalism and this and that, what have you. He's kind of spouting these very generic film school type ideas and themes that are, you know, straight out the textbook. You know, I was kind of like rolling my eyes a little bit. Yeah, I know this is all bad, whatever. And it ends with he's there with a woman who seems to sympathize with him. And I guess I shouldn't spoil it, but since I don't know how many people are going to watch this or when it's going to be released, if it's going to be released, he's embraced by her, but then an alarm goes off and she says, okay, our time's up. See you next time. Have fun. Goodbye. You know, be sure to pay us on Venmo or Cash App. And he's like, what the hell? You know, he's like, but stay a little longer, you know, that kind of thing. It's beautifully shot. You know, it's got a lot of superimpositions where images kind of blur and fade into one another. It's got mirror imaging where, like, he's on one side, but it's the same image on the other side, and they're kind of meeting in the middle. It's black and white, which always, to me, is the better option to go for from a cinematography standpoint, at least for the actors. That's something Orson Welles had said once before, and I really agree with that. Black and white is the actor's best friend.
Speaking of early shit posters.
Another early shit poster, yes. Exactly. That guy, he could spout off some stuff, you know, and I would be there for it. But Hypoxia overall, you know, I gave it 2 out of 5 because I just didn't feel like there was enough of a story or that his monologue was all that interesting. The characters seem to be very tired and exhausted, but yelling anyways. You know, like he's still got a little left in him and he's going to shout it out, almost like Howard Beale from Network. Although he wasn't as manic at all. He didn't have that kind of spark to him. He was just sad and pathetic, you know. The photography was really trying to spice it up a bit, but the movie didn't really have much of a chance beyond that. I'm sorry to say. The third short film, or the second in this one-on-one dueling short film thing where I'm kind of copping out and doing both instead of just one of them, is called The Influencer. Now, immediately when you hear that word, you think social media, right? And that's exactly what this is. It's described as a social media influencer describes her perfect day harvesting the eyes and minds of her followers to achieve immortality.
Sick.
Now, one could take that and go, okay, what does that mean? You know, does this mean she wants to live on forever, like, metaphorically, you know, or, you know, like, oh, you know, I posted some really good stuff today or yesterday and tomorrow after that. And, you know, as an influencer, I really stuck it to the people. Well, it kind of means the eyes and minds a little literally. After all, this is a horror film. You get what I'm saying? It they don't specify if it's TikTok or if it's Instagram. I think it's more Instagram. But you see her in the vertical video, you know, holding it like a selfie video. And you see the people commenting on it, you know, in the little chat group on the corner of the screen. Like, hey, how was your day? We love you. You know, that kind of stuff. And she's like, I love you back. And, you know, here's my day. It's very chill. It's very basic. You know, she's talking, you know, very cool, very calm today words, you know, that the young people use. And then we see quick cuts to, I guess, her group of friends. She talks about her pals, you know, her crew. It's like three younger women. And it wasn't clear also that these specific women were the crew that she was talking about. But nonetheless, we follow them. They go to a club. They're also social media fans. Not necessarily influencers yet, but they are big on it. And they go to a club, and the pulsating song that's playing is constantly saying, I want to be a god. However, when I first heard it, I thought it said, I want to be a cog. And maybe it was supposed to be both. Maybe you're not really supposed to be sure what it's saying. Maybe they are cogs in a machine. Maybe they do want to be a god. I don't know. And I guess to give away... I don't like to give away... Well, actually, I do. Spoilers or whatever. But I'll try not to do that with the features that I'm going to talk about. But they pick up a guy. They all have fun, have drinks, that kind of thing. And he wakes up in the trunk of their car And I'm thinking, like, okay, he had a fun night. You know, he gets out of the trunk. He's like, wait, what did I do? You know, that kind of thing. And he's looking around. This is the first part of the movie where it's not from a social media perspective. It's not from a phone. You know what I mean? It's not recorded from a phone or a security camera or anything like that. It's just regular movie. You know, it's like we're brought out of it. Now we're into the narrative. And the women bring him out to the beach and basically sacrifice him to this ocean god who turns out to be the woman that was the wraparound story. And she pulls his eyes out of the guy's head and says something about, you know, we are the leaders and we are the, you know, I don't know. I'm making this seem like my reaction is very tepid or not as impressed, but from a visual standpoint, this was very impressive. There's a lot of light that's used. They bring back the ring light. You know, if people out there are aware, cool, of this, you know, ring lights are what are kind of like a nice way to brighten up your face when you're recording something for social media or for whatever.
But it gives people's eyes that demonic glow because there's just like a white ring of light, like, and shining in their eyeballs.
I will bring that up in the next movie that I'm going to talk about. There is one scene that's just like that, and it's really creepy as hell. But this movie doesn't quite reach creepy as hell, you know, but it does. I gave it 3.5 out of 5 because from a technical standpoint, it had my attention, and I did honestly feel it was very entertaining. And maybe it has something to say, you know, more so than Hypoxia. You know, Hypoxia was straight surface, you know, it was straight, like, you know, the guy's talking about capitalism and how life sucks. And then the woman he's with turns out to be part of that system. And she's like, okay, follow me on, you know, pay me on Venmo. See you later. Bye. I was like, oh, okay. This movie seems to be a little more coy, I guess, about it. You know, I'm playful about what exactly it's going after. Because when it ends, and then throughout the end credits, it's just the woman god who's now back to being her social media influencer self, just talking on the phone, through the phone, you know, on an Instagram or something to her followers. And she's like, oh yeah, today we did this and da 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 da. You know, I have a good recipe for this and da da.
She's influencing.
Yeah, she's influencing. It was very amusing, I thought. So yeah, I guess that one is amusing.
I love cyber horror. Like, I'm really into it. So that sounds great.
Yeah.
The eyeballs thing reminds me too. Like, we just covered this movie for the podcast, but have you ever seen Anguish from the 80s with Zelda Rubinstein?
Ooh, no, I haven't.
It's like it's another one that's like set in a movie theater. But like, oh, you really start out watching this like horror movie where Zelda Rubinstein is the mother of this like very, you know, reclusive son, and she commands him to go out and steal people's eyeballs. And then you pull back to show kind of teenagers watching that movie in the theater, and there's a killer in the theater walking around potentially taking people's eyeballs.
It sounds like I did watch a movie like this. It's from Uruguay called The Last Matinee.
Oh, that looked good. I never saw that.
It was very good. I really enjoyed it. It's about a serial killer who stalks a movie theater audience and plucks their eyeballs out.
Yeah. There's something similar going on in that influencer premise. It's just like, instead of the theater, you know, the phone can get you anywhere. That's like when you're scrolling in bed or bored on the toilet or waiting for a bus. You know,
bored on the toilet. Okay. The two features I want to spotlight. Well, I'm going to start with Red Rooms.
Ooh, I liked this one a lot.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, my God. Now, I gave it 4 out of 5, but that's, to me, on my rating scale, that's almost equivalent, almost as exactly equivalent to a 5 out of 5. 5 out of 5 is, I guess, a lot of people see as perfect. I put an asterisk next to it and say, perfect to me, or it's very special to me.
I rate based on enthusiasm instead of like objective quality. I don't really
care
about
that. It's kind of like that too. 4 out of 5 is also very good in my opinion. Might as well be the same thing, but it's a technicality maybe. Red Rooms by Pascal Plante. It's a, in fact, both the films, feature films I'm going to talk about, are from Quebec. They're both Canada movies, Canadian films. And I was like, what better double feature, you know, to talk about? And they're very good movies. Red Rooms is the tale of a, I don't think she's a supermodel, but she is a advertising model.
She's a fashion model.
Fashion model, okay. She's a young woman. We don't really know that at first, though. She enters a court building, like a, you know, like a local building where they have various courtrooms. And she enters this one in particular. And at first I thought it was like an execution room, because the way it's laid out, we see this prisoner guy enter a glass, like a little glass partition. That's just his little mini room where he sits down. And the camera slowly sweeps from, at first it just shows you the room where the audience is sitting. And we know that they're in some kind of court area or some kind of prison. We're not exactly sure. And then we see his little room. Then the camera sweeps and expands. And we see it's a courtroom and that he's on trial. And it was just something that I didn't really expect, because I haven't seen a courtroom look like that before.
Yeah, it's very sterile and like super white light. Like it looks like kind of like a science lab more than a courthouse.
That's a good way of putting it.
But also that shot just keeps going on. Like all through the opening arguments, it just sweeps all around the room. I don't think it breaks.
I think it breaks only at the end, and maybe a little bit here and there. But for the most part, it gives you the sense of a one take.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what matters, is that it that's not necessarily that it is a one take, but if they had to break, you don't really feel it or see it. And throughout this one take, you hear the prosecutor give her case. You hear the defense team give their case, their arguments to the jury. You know, the judge explains to the jury what this all is all about. And every once in a while, as the camera's kind of revolving around everyone, we see in the background this woman, and she's kind of staring into their souls, so to speak, you know, into like, a lot of times it's really just on the prisoner guy, you know, the defendant, but a lot of times it's also into the camera, a lot of times it's also into the prosecutor, to the judge. You know, she's very, you know, like, mysterious, and it's very like, what are her motivations? Why is she here? Is she involved in this case? Does she have a past history with this guy? And the guy we even focus on a little bit too, the defendant, he's like in this, what is essentially like a glass cage. Maybe it's plastic, I don't know. And he's sitting there in just one little chair, and he's like diddling with his fingers, like his fingernails, kind of cleaning them a little bit. And we're like, is he a psychopath who's unfeeling? Or is he just depressed? Is he just sad and trying to figure out what to do with his hands? You know, what's the deal here? It's a very great opening, because it's very mundane, but it's also very intense. We're not sure exactly what to expect from here on, you know, and I love that. The movie is about, it's about this fashion model who, she is also very good with, I guess it's hacking, but it seems to be very simple hacking. She's just very intuitive when it comes to finding information online.
She's like connected to the deep web.
Yeah, the deep web, and then she gets into the dark web. She very much knows how to work her way through things and solve puzzles in terms of like, okay, I have to access this Wi-Fi in order to hide my identity, in order to get access to this piece of information that will tell me this and that. You know, it's almost like she's Google searching how to be a hacker. She's not necessarily a hacker herself, but she's very good at this. She might as well be a pro.
She's also really into Bitcoin and also into online compulsive poker. Video poker, where she like earns her Bitcoin.
Apparently that's where she earns most of her money, aside from, you know, her fashion modeling.
Or like neon demon photo shoots.
Yeah, those were kind of weird, but I like those things. The, you know, it's the flashing lights, all that stuff. She makes a friend in this younger woman who might as well be right out of high school, or college. She's kind of unkempt a little bit, you know, like her hair is kind of, you know, a little bit of a mess. She, you know, I think the reason why she looks the way she looks, this younger character, is because she just got off a bus from a town a little farther away from Montreal. She came into the city specifically to see the court case, to be in the audience. And turns out she's like a fan of the defendant. You know, it's not 100% clear at first that she's got romantic feelings for the guy, but it becomes clear later on that's essentially what this is. She's like an obsessive fan or an affectionate fan.
Like a Jeffrey Dahmer kind of thing, except Dahmer was actually like kind of handsome, and this guy is very much not.
Just a very meek looking nerd.
He's very visibly guilty too. Like as soon as you see him, you're like, ugh.
he almost knows he's fucked, you know?
Right.
He's,
right.
He's just kind of sitting there, his head down, you know, that kind of thing. And only one moment do we see him look anywhere else. And that's later in the movie. And that's a fucked up scene. But, so she kind of takes this young lady in, cause she, I guess, sees that they're almost like, similar in a lot of ways, although the young girl's more, I guess you can say, energetic about this whole thing. The main character, she lives in a very small apartment. It seems to be primarily just her and her AI assistant, which is very much educated and intuitive system that she mostly uses for checking emails and stuff. You know, her lifestyle is very, very hooked into the net. This might as well be called the Net 3.0. That's a reference to the Sandra Bullock movie and the bad sequel that followed. Although you could argue maybe the original was bad too, but I kind of like.
I like the first one. I haven't seen the second one.
Yeah, I didn't care to see the second one. I was like, no, I just needed the Sandra Bullock one. That's it. And that was the early days of the internet, mind you. You know, we didn't. She's ordering pizza.
It's so dumb that people mock that scene in particular. Just because, like, once Domino's invented the pizza tracker, people were like addicted to it, and they thought it was the coolest thing.
But it was like pizza.com she went to. It was simpler,
a little generic.
So Red Rooms. The defendant is on trial for possibly having killed three high school girls whose murders were specifically filmed for the purpose of them being murdered for an online audience on the dark web, in what's called red rooms. You know, red being blood, I guess, or the lights, you know, and blood. We only get glimpses of the footage. We don't see anything. We just hear a lot, you know, the screams, and the screams are terrifying. They're piercing and horrible. We hear saws. We hear all sorts of grotesque things that are happening. And we're mostly seeing the facial reactions of those who, usually it's typically Kellyanne and the young woman who is named Clementine. And Clementine's more of a novice, you know, she's very naive, but she's also like wanting to learn, you know, and all that stuff. And throughout the film, we're not really sure, again, I said this before, what Kellyanne's motivations are. We slowly learn bit by bit her journey, you know, like, is she an online investigator? Is she, you know, like an amateur online investigator? Is she just fascinated by this case and it's kind of like a hobby for her? Does she have feelings for this guy, just like Clementine? Does she, like, what is her deal? And slowly but surely, she kind of goes into this, down this rabbit hole that is basically a void of weird psychosis and obsession.
Yeah, it's like almost an exaggeration of true crime obsession. It's just like she likes to be up front in the front row, you know, staring down the person she's obsessed with.
She's kind of in the back row for the most part.
Well, yeah, she's as close as she's legally allowed to be.
The moment where she crosses the line.
Oh, I don't want to spoil that.
Oh, I'm sorry. Is that a spoiler?
Never mind. I don't care.
I won't go any further than that. But she crosses the line and crosses the line several times before, you know, things end. And there are all these expectations you have or that I had watching it. Like, trying to figure out how it's going to, where it's going to go. Is she going to do something right? Is she going to keep going and doing something wrong? Is she going to see a red room? Is she going to be in one? You know, what exactly is the end game here? And that is always a good sign of a good movie, really good movie, when it's so tense that you are questioning everything. You don't know where it's heading.
Yeah, it's got that kind of David Fincher, like, cold thriller thing going for it, where you're, like, kind of on edge, waiting to see what's going to happen.
This is the coldest of thrillers in that sense. I wouldn't even, I mean, David Fincher in terms of, like, maybe the genre, the type of movie he would make out of Red Rooms, but this is not what I would call a Fincher film. Maybe Friedkin, actually. It's got a little bit of that going for it, I felt. Maybe
I see not. A lot of Fincher in this. The sort of Nine Inch Nails kind of, like, even when she's, like, working out in her, like, yoga outfit, she's, like, doing aerobics to what sounds like if Trent Reznor produced, like, a Miley Cyrus
album.
Oh, yeah. And then there's also, you know, the cold clinical courtroom. And then you get, like, when she's watching the Red Rooms, this kind of, like, glow of the computer screen on her face is very Fincherian. And the way the camera floats around that courtroom in that first shot is, like, I don't know, something like Panic Room or something like that.
Well, I suppose in those ways, the style is very, very Fincher. But I guess what I'm speaking to is the overall atmosphere, which is very twisted and intense and a little subversive too. I mean, it's, you know, it's not sickening because obviously we don't see the very messed up footage of the murders, but it's sickening in terms of how far she's willing to go and what she hopes to get out of this. And if she hopes to get anything out of it, how close to the edge she can go and how farther past it. You know, it's interesting. I don't know exactly what freaking movie I might compare it to.
Can I liken it to one more Fincher movie?
Yeah. Go for it.
Gone Girl in particular.
Yeah.
Gone Girl. Like, there are a couple events in Gone Girl that are very shocking, but for the most part, the sort of reveal of that movie is not actual things that happen or actual actions from the, I don't know, anti-heroine villain of that piece. It's more like character reveals. Like, the more you learn about her, you're like, well, that's weird. And then the next reveal, you're like, okay, that's really improbable, but what a strange person.
Yeah.
And it just keeps getting stranger and stranger as it goes along. And I think this one has the same thing where, you know, you meet this woman who's, you know, obsessed with serial killers. That's a little strange. And then you find out she's a fashion model, which, you know, it's an unusual job to have as your, like, main profession. And then she's a fashion model hacker, which feels even weirder. And it just feels like every new character reveal is just another strange wrinkle to her persona, where, like, the actual killing of these teenagers that happened before the movie even started,
it's like,
and, like, the investigation of that. Yeah. It doesn't matter as much as, like, how strange the central character is. And she just gets weirder and weirder and weirder until the movie ends.
That's the thing. It is, like I said before, I don't think she is technically a hacker. She just knows where to look. And, the problem with her is that she wants to look at these things. She wants to see these things. She wants to go that far. And she's a fashion model. She should be more, you would think the stereotype is of a fashion model. And I'm sure not all of them are like this. It's a stereotype. But you would think in a movie, they would go for vapid. They would go for image obsessed, you know, stuff like that. And she does do yoga. She does exercise and work out in her little apartment, which the movie points out she does not sleep in.
Well, she sleeps on the streets only before the trial to get first in line, so she can get a seat, I think.
See, I'm not sure if that's what it is, because she's not really sleeping. She's sleeping in the city, in a very specific spot, a very quiet street, I guess on a stoop or something. And it's not exactly, I don't know how far away she is to the courthouse. It's not like she has a tent or anything. It's not like, you know, before an event goes live on Ticketmaster or something, or at the arena, you know.
That is how I read it, is that it's, like, right outside the frame. Like, she's, like, right by the courthouse.
It's possible.
And that's why she keeps running into Clementine right there. But either way, another strange character detail. Like, a deeply strange thing for a person to do.
She comes off rather emotionless, almost sociopathic.
yeah,
in a lot of ways, except in the instances where she's got that red glow from the computer screen on her, when she's seeing things she wants to see. It's almost like a visual orgasm in a way. Those are the only parts where she really shows some level of pleasure in what she's consuming or what she's found.
You know? And I guess that's where the movie gets into like the psychology of like true crime obsession, where like she probably started watching, you know, kind of the Netflix brand documentary about like white women being abducted and murdered. And then eventually she needed like stronger and stronger stuff to get that sensation out of it. And by the end of the film, she's like, you know, purchasing like snuff films with Bitcoin, you know, like she's gone too far into that obsession.
It reminds me of a time when I did watch a couple of Netflix docuseries, like the one about the pizza delivery guy who had the bomb strapped to his neck.
Oh, yeah.
That was a very good one. Evil Genius, I believe was what it was called. It wasn't about that guy was not the criminal. It was he was forced to do it by the evil genius. And the one that I want to highlight with respect to Red Rooms is I believe it's called Don't F with Cats. And it's about this this ring of online investigators, specifically like I said before, amateur criminal investigators who might as well be pros. They start looking into these videos that are popping online about that are this masked guy basically strangling cats or killing cats in different fashion, because they're freaked out about it, but are also worried that the next at some point it's going to be a person. And at some point it does become a person in Canada who is killed, I believe, in Montreal, although it could have been Edmonton. Montreal is obviously in a different spot than Edmonton, but I think it was Montreal where this guy killed another guy in his apartment and then cut up the body and did some horrible stuff to it. You know, they don't go into it too deeply because that would be truly traumatizing. But when I was watching it in my room. And I was sitting in my chair. The room was well lit. I watched the whole thing like in a binge, and I kept looking behind my back, like naturally. I was just like, no one behind me, am I safe, you know, that kind of thing. It's one of those the type of docuseries that gets stuck in your head for a while and you can't get the images out. You know, once you see something like that, you don't really forget it, or it's very difficult to forget. And in the case of Kellyanne, the character Kellyanne from Red Rooms, I guess it got embedded so deeply that she needed more, you know, and more, and you get closer and closer, you know. And it's a really interesting like horror type movie out in that it's not, you know, it's not like an Eli Roth hostile movie, like torture porn, which is what you would maybe expect from something involving the dark web, you know. This is more like post dark web, you know. This is like the aftermath of a killing, you know. And what happens to people when they get overly exposed to this kind of information. It's a very messed up movie in that manner, and I love it. I love it when a movie can go that far without going that far.
Yeah, it's like not exactly torture porn. It's not exactly
porn whatsoever, no.
It's not a cyber thriller exactly, but it touches on those topics. It's more like a character study of an absolute sicko. You get to know her more and more.
And I did want to bring up one bit. I think I mentioned it before that I was going to reference it regarding a ring light. This isn't a ring light, so to speak, but it is similar to what the ring light did in the other short film, The Influencer. Kellyanne goes into a place and she pulls out her phone and she's taking like selfie photos. And the room is very dark. You can barely see anything, but she has the flash on. And when it flashes very quickly on her face is like smiling very widely and almost contorted in a very twisted way. Almost. It's almost like the Joker, kind of, you know, from the Batman villain. And that's the only Joker we know of. And but it reminded me of Laura Dern in Inland Empire, David Lynch's Empire, when she's like slowly running to the camera, and then the last few steps, she's like right in the face of the camera, and her face is so morphed and messed up that it's just like a shock to the system. It was particularly scary, that those few little bits. But that's Red Rooms for you. The second feature, or the last film I'm gonna spotlight here, is called Humanist Vampire Seeking Consenting Suicidal Person. I suppose this movie's a comedy, but I guess the word for it is melancholy or gothic comedy, maybe, or macabre. You know, maybe it's macabre. The movie's about a young vampire woman who at one point she says she is 68 years old, or rather years young, but really she looks like she's a high school senior type, you know. When the movie starts, she's a little girl who is introduced to the concept of killing and eating people by her family. You know, they're trying to bring her into that and help her grow up and learn the ways of being a vampire. But instead, she suffers from PTSD from witnessing a birthday clown getting mutilated before her eyes.
Whoa.
By her family. We don't see that. We just see her kind of like shocked as hell. And she's very smart. She's like a young savant in a way. She instantly knows how to play a keyboard, you know, a piano. And she goes to doctors and therapists her vampire parents bring her to, who I guess are specializing in vampire science. Maybe they're just underground scientists who are also vampires. That part's not really clear, but I guess they can't go to a regular doctor. So they go to these doctors and they basically tell them, look, the part of her brain that is compassionate kicks in whenever she sees someone in danger. So it's likely that she'll need to drink blood from a pack, not go hunting. Or that's not going to happen for a while. So the movie's kind of about her trying to come into her own, not just as a woman, but as a vampire. And those two elements cross over when she meets as a 68-year-old teenager. She meets a suicidal young man who is a high school kid who works at a bowling alley. And she sees him on the roof of the bowling alley just about to try to jump off of it. Which apparently is part of many attempts he's tried, but it has kind of failed at doing for one reason or another. This kid is picked on and bullied and everything you can imagine. It's not entirely clear that that's what's causing him to be suicidal, but it definitely isn't helping. He kind of meets the vampire, Sasha is her name, by serendipity. You know, he is preparing to kill himself again by jumping off something. And she's taking an interest in him, but he accidentally bashes his head against something, like he walks into or runs into some piece of steel or something. And he sees her fangs, which have just grown out for the first time. So it's almost like, I suppose, coming into puberty in a way. You know, it's kind of representing of that. And the next time they meet, they're at a suicide support group. And instantly when they lock eyes, it's like they know what's up, you know. She is extremely hesitant to go hunting, and her parents and her family are very much pushing her in that direction. Though her father's more understanding. He's like, no, give her time, you know, that kind of thing. It's a very interesting dynamic between the family and her. You know, it reminds me almost like of a Matthew McConaughey quote unquote comedy that he used to be in before he started taking more serious roles. Failure to launch.
His himbo era.
Yeah, right. So anyways, the film, you know, they strike up a relationship, and basically he's offering himself to her like as victim, but he's not a victim. He just wants to die. And he's like, hey, look, you know, you're a cool person. I know you're a vampire, but I want to die. You need to eat. Let's just do this, you know. And she's looking for every excuse not to, because she's very scared, you know. So they kind of go out trying to fulfill his dying wishes. And it's kind of one of those, I want to say trial and error or slapstick, but those are incorrect. It's almost comedy of error, but I would say it's more cutesy.
Twee, maybe?
Yeah, I would say it's more cutesy. The cutesy little mini adventures they go on, where he's basically trying to accomplish the things that he never thought he could in his regular life, you know, but now that he knows it's going to die, he's like, hey, look, I could, you know, this will be my dying wish, I guess. I'm going to get back at the people that were mean to me. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. And she helps him through it, of course. But the movie is very, 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 very entertaining, very funny in a lot of bits. I hope I'm not trying to oversell it as a comedy, because it really isn't. It's not an Adam Sandler movie. It's not really a romantic comedy at all either, or a teenage hookup movie, or something where it's a lot more like laugh out loud. This is much more macabre melancholy, I think is the best way to put it. Not bittersweet, but definitely a little more darkened than that. You know, she has a cousin vampire who has an interesting apartment, which is like, I guess it used to be a butcher shop or some kind of meat factory, because once you enter her building, it's got meat hooks right there above the kitchen counter. And when she brings home two guys at one point, she's like, hey, you pick one of them and I'll pick the other and we'll get to work. And of course, Sasha's a little, you know, she's like, I don't know, I'll just drink out of the bag tonight. And in the background, when she goes into her room, you know, in the background, we hear her cousin going like, hey, you guys want to try this out? It's kind of like a swing. And they're like, hey, yeah, we were into this. Cool. She's like, you like that? And they're like, no, this hurts. What the hell are you doing? Ah, you know, but Sasha, from her point of view, she's just kind of like awkward. Like, oh, that's going on in the background. Is this what I'm going to have to do later? You know, that kind of thing. So it does have that sense of humor, but it's not in your face about it. It's definitely there, but it's more blended into the background, into the environment, into the setting. What's more important in the movie is Sasha coming into her own body as it matures. And it's taken like 68 years, but for her, in vampire time. But it's happening now. And she's kind of struggling with the emotions, the chemical imbalances and all that stuff. And the new feelings she's having and things like that. But yeah, her and the lonely teenager character she meets that wants to die, Paul, they just strike up this little mini friendship over the course of one night. And he still wants to die. And she's just scared to eat someone, you know, and that's how they get along. So I guess in that sense it is a comedy, but like I said, it's more macabre melancholy, you know, it's a little sad, but it's still very funny in that regard. I loved this movie. Absolutely. I loved it more, a tad bit more than Red Rooms. I think this is, if you can pick one of these two as a more conventional movie, this would probably be it. But even then, it's not conventional. This isn't Lisa Frankenstein.
I was thinking of that when you were describing it. Like, there are more zombie-type movies, like Warm Bodies, Lisa Frankenstein, Life After Beth. They kind of hit that melancholy rom-com note.
But this isn't even really a rom-com. That's the thing. This is
a friend-com? I don't know.
A platonic-com?
Platon-com.
Platon-com, yeah. I guess that's kind of what this is. But I wouldn't even call it romance or whatever. It's macabre melancholy. It's very...
A girl walks home alone at night, I guess.
Yes, that was almost in that vein. But that was like a romance, you know, in a weird way, you know, in an interesting way. That very much had romantic feelings. This movie, you want there to be romantic feelings, but it kind of doesn't really go in that way. You know, they seem to have an affection towards one another, but it's really more of a friendly affection or attraction than it is romantic. And there's never a scene where they're coming close to kissing or anything along those lines. As a matter of fact, if they come close at all, it's to her biting him. you know, and I guess that's part of the tension is like, when's she gonna do it, you know? And she's constantly like, sometimes fighting that urge, other times she's like fighting the expectation of having that urge, and also trying to buy time so that way she can figure things out, maybe spend a little more time with this guy who kind of is a little like her. You know, she has issues. She almost wants to die too. Like, oh, being a vampire sucks, you know, that kind of thing. She reminds me of not Wednesday Addams, but the girl from Beetlejuice.
Lydia?
Yeah, Lydia, the one that Winona Ryder plays.
Who I believe is being played by Wednesday Addams, Jenny Ortega in the new one.
Yeah,
playing her daughter or something.
Yeah, well, that's Hollywood's go-to. You know, they typecast, you know, that kind of thing. But good for her. You know, good for Jenna Ortega. You know, whatever.
Fuck it. Let her play Beetlejuice. Why not?
Yeah, let her be Beetlejuice. You know, let her be like the younger new generation of Beetlejuice. but then people would say that's woke. That's woke.
Those aren't really people, Bill. I wouldn't worry about it.
Yeah, you're right.
Well, I'm going to throw in a few that I really liked. I'm going to go to like the top of my list.
All right.
I'll start with the two that I thought were actually scary. Like, I heard some people kind of grumbling outside of the very last movie I saw at the fest, like, finally, a scary movie at a horror movie festival.
Oh, fuck those people.
Yeah. Not specifically what I'm looking for when I go to horror movies. Like, I really like the break from reality.
Definitely. Horror doesn't have to be about spooks. Ooh, it's spooky, you know, or scary.
But I get it. You know, like, I get the complaint, because if you are someone who, like, loves this genre more than you love anything else, you do like to be unnerved, you know, startled, creeped out. Like, there is something intrinsically valuable about that, even if it's not the main reason you're there. I'm glad that I saw two movies that actually scared me. You know, like, I spent 4 days at a shopping mall watching horror movies. It's good that there were two that, you know, were scary.
The shopping mall, ladies and gentlemen, is Britannia Canal Place.
Yes.
The third floor of Canal Place is the Britannia. So that's the movie theater.
I love calling it a shopping mall because it is.
It is, yeah. It is kind of a weird place for, well, not really. Well, malls have had movie theaters before, so it's fine.
I always like getting out of the midnight movie there. You know, the last movie on every day schedule ends at midnight. And as you're leaving, it's just eerie to be in this like mall where everything else is closed and you're leaving, you're tired. And I don't know, just got a surreal feeling to it. But the two movies that spooked me are both going to be on Shudder at some point. One was this French film called Infested. It is about spiders that infest a housing block in Paris.
Didn't the Overlook have like a photo booth where they'll put tarantulas on your face?
I saw, yeah, there was like a photo op with a little red carpet. Meet the stars of Infested. By which they sit in a chair and they put the spiders on your face.
Yeah.
I did not participate in this.
I'm on the Letterboxd page right now for Infested. And that's not fair. That's not a fair joke.
It's not a very similar movie. I would say, you know, you hear horror movie about spiders.
More comedy than anything.
Yeah. Like, you kind of expect this kind of goofball creature feature. Maybe the spiders are like, you know, building size and David Arquette's running away from them, but not in
you
this case.
You ain't like it, freaks.
In this case, like, this actually plays more like a film festival drama about the community that lives in this housing project. Like, the movie, because the spiders are kind of like instantly so upsetting, like, you don't have to try very hard to make a spider crawling all over your face trying to lay eggs inside of you creepy. Like, that works. Kind of already done by biology.
It kind of already is freaky by itself.
Right.
Yeah. Some people keep spiders as pets, but, you know.
Right. You still don't want them crawling all over you of you.
Not when you're not inviting it. You know, if you have it on your hand, that's fine, and you know it's there, but. Yeah.
So there's a lot of time to set up the characters and, like, the world before the spider attack. And it feels like a pretty standard French drama about this, like, poverty line community in this housing project and how they all take care of each other, and, you know, they might have their little squabbles, but it's basically like a family by proximity in this building, and that makes it more upsetting later when the spiders are everywhere, because, you know, your survival instincts kick in and you're like, I can't let you into my apartment right now, and you're like closing the door on somebody that you would have considered like a brother to you the day before, you know? So it has an extra dramatic layer to it. But really, the reason it's freaky is because they import these spiders from another country that quickly breed and then mutate into these giant beasts that cocoon the building in on itself. No one can leave. And the spiders just like wreak total havoc. And every single jump scare actually made me jump like a foot in the air. Like, it just got me every single time, kind of like as a reflex. Like, I had no choice but to be freaked out by it, you know?
The cocooning of the building sounds a lot like what happens in The Suckling. You ever see The Suckling?
Yeah.
It's like the creature in that movie kind of covers the build, or at least the exits, with its own bodily fluid or sinew or whatever. Sounds a little like that. And that by itself is pretty gross. And
I referred to that as being skinamarinked when I watched The Suckling, because it's very similar. Just like there's no exit.
There's no exit. Track
of time in there. Yeah.
You're trapped. There ain't nowhere else to go, baby.
There's another layer to that too, where like the cops are kind of guarding the perimeter of the building and quarantining people inside with the spiders. So like there's kind of this like police brutality angle on it as well, where they're not letting them leave just as much as the spider beasts are keeping them trapped inside.
We're just roping off the area.
Right, yeah, it's for your own safety, which is total bullshit.
No, it's for your own safety.
Maybe the other scary one I saw was a little more inventive, because it doesn't have the benefit of spiders being naturally freaky, but it was this Irish ghost story called Oddity.
Oh, see, I thought you were going to say, when you said Irish, I thought you were going to say, what's this one called?
All You Need Is Death.
All You Need Is Death, because I think that one got some special praise, you know, like specific, like that one was...
Like an audience award or something?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. Well, maybe not audience award, but it won something. But Oddity, I do remember the image for it, that was promoted on the program. And it was like this old monsterish creepy thing with its jaw open.
Yeah, it's a wooden puppet that like looks all gnarled and demonic.
Okay.
And they get an extra scare out of the movie by propping that puppet at the exit of the theater. So as you're walking out, you're already on edge because the movie was scary. And then you see the puppet in real life right in front of you on the way out. And I believe they were filming people's reactions too, which was kind of cute. Well, doing my journalistic due diligence here, actually, Oddity won the audience award at this year's festival. And the runner-up was a humanist vampire seeking consenting suicidal person.
Yes!
So, sweet. I don't see All You Need Is Death listed on here. I'm sure someone praised it for something.
Someone praised it. Maybe I mistook it for
whatever. You got a shout out somewhere. But in Oddity, that puppet, that wooden puppet, is the property of a blind psychic. She has a special spiritual ability to read the aura of physical objects, like personal possessions of someone. She can like read their spiritual energy, and she uses that to communicate with the dead. And in particular, she is using the ghosts from haunted objects to avenge her sister's death, including that puppet. So like, I don't want to spoil too much of the movie, but a lot of it is her, this like blind woman sitting in the quiet, in the dark, in this house where her sister was murdered, and kind of like weaponizing all of these cursed objects and the ghosts that are attached to them to both solve the mystery of her sister's murder and also kill the people who did it through the strength of the ghosts that she like can communicate with through these objects. And the way it gets its scares is by setting up these very like routine jump scares where like the soundtrack gets very quiet. You know that something's going to jump out at you, but every time it cuts to a ghost, like it actually had me jumping, got under my skin. The atmosphere of it's very icy, but weirdly funny in this kind of like cruel Irish sense of humor. Yeah, I really liked it. I think Oddity's like, if you're just looking for pure scares out of your horror movies, like this one actually delivers on that. As does the one with the spiders that want to impregnate your body, which, you know, kind of a cheat.
It's kind of a cheat, really?
Yeah, I think it's like I think Oddity works a lot harder for its scares than Infested does.
Well, I would say Infested, by the sound of it, is more natural. You know, that's a natural fear that a lot of
people have. Right, it's reflexive. And to be honest, the movie makes up for it by investing in the characters. Like, you care about each death in Infested a lot. I don't know that you care about the people in Oddity as much, but the scenario is so strange. The scares are so effective that it's still a very satisfying movie.
Okay. Did you see anything else?
Yeah, I want to jump into the stuff that like I actually show up to the festival for, which is like not necessarily to be scared, but just like horror has an ability to just open up every possibility of the imagination.
Yeah.
And it's such a profitable genre that like audiences are willing to show up for anything that like, I really feel like it gives people freedom to just do whatever. And the two movies I saw that I think really pay off on that are ones that will be kind of like indie hits this year, like, or at least buzzy movies. One was Cuckoo by Tillman Singer.
Oh,
whose
yes.
Previous film Lose was this like body possession demonic thing. He's a German filmmaker. And I believe Lose was his kind of thesis project for film school. It was a very low budget movie, but it's super strange, psychedelic experience where almost all of its horror is conveyed through dialogue. And it just really unnerves you. And Cuckoo is very similar. Like, it's set at this German Alps cabin where Hunter Schafer plays this kind of grumpy teenager whose mother just passed away. And she goes to this cabin with her father and his new family. And the place is run by Dan Stevens, doing this really over the top German accent. He's like really playing like a mustache twirling villain in this.
Oh, nice.
And the two of them square off. Like, it's pretty obvious he's going to be like the horror movie, like mad scientist villain of the piece. And basically this like resort is a cover for him doing these like medical experiments that involve this cryptid woman who lives in the woods. And much like in Lose, the movie doesn't like try that hard visually to upset you. The cryptid creature that he's experimenting with basically just looks like a woman with a trench coat and a headscarf and sunglasses. Like, she's not, you know, like some strange, unknowable creature. It looks humanoid, but it's not human. And the more and more you learn about it, the more upsetting it is.
Oh, okay. I see. Yeah.
But the scares are really disorienting in the same way Lose was. It's very dialogue based. And it's one of those things where like, the more you explain it, the weirder it is. Like, it doesn't actually answer any questions. It just makes it stranger. I always think of M. Night Shyamalan when I think of that kind of reveal where it's like, there's this big twist revelation about what's really going on. And every time you get that from Shyamalan, it's like, wait a second, that just made me ask like 100 different questions than my original question. That didn't actually solve the mystery for me. That just made it even weirder. And I think, you know, Cuckoo does that very well. And it's very cool to see Hunter Schafer and Dan Stevens get a lot to do. They're both very charismatic performers, and it's, you know, cool seeing Hunter Schafer wield a butterfly knife against people who are trying to kill her, and Dan Stevens playing this like really cartoonish villain that I don't think he's really played since The Guest. I have seen him in several movies this year, and he's very goofy in all of them. I think the biggest one was Godzilla X Kong, but yeah. Like, I don't think the material is worthy of his, you know, goofballery. Like, I think at Cuckoo, he's actually given a lot to do.
Okay.
Which I've been waiting for since The Guest. I guess that's what I was saying. It's like a meatier role while still allowing him to like do his full like Peter Sellers goofy accent thing that he's been into lately. It's very, very silly, but the movie actually does like unnerve you and feels like off-putting and psychedelic in a surprising way too. So I definitely recommend seeing that one in the theater when it comes out.
Nice.
And even more so, probably the best feature film I've seen so far this year was Jane Schoenbrunn's I Saw the TV Glow.
Yeah, I'm really, really excited for this. I think it's coming out, what, May? Early May?
Yeah.
Like officially? Yeah.
And it is backed by A24, so it will play everywhere. I guess I won't say that much about it because it probably will be discussed on the show later when more people have seen it.
Yeah.
I'll just say a lot of the frustration with their first feature film, not including their Slender Man documentary, which I really liked, but they made
which
this movie.
The Slender Man documentary, what was that one called?
It's called A Self-Induced Hallucination.
Yes, yes, that's what it is. And I don't think it's available right now, right?
They actually posted a link to it on archive.org or something. I think someone uploaded a version of it and they were like, wait a second, that's not my favorite cut of the movie. That's like an earlier cut. And they issued a more like a director's final edit version of it. Yeah. So that one and We're All Going to the World's Fair, which was their,
I love that one.
Their big breakout drama. Those are both very much about like the isolation of the internet. And I think the frustration with World's Fair was that it was marketed as a horror movie, kind of like Red Rooms, like, you know, this character accesses this like dark web evil that, you know, then breaks her mind. But in truth, the movie is just this kind of like low budget drama about a very lonely teenager who purposefully tricks herself into believing in this like non-existent evil to make her life more interesting. And then when it doesn't work, it gets very dark. And I think a lot of people were like kind of put off by the marketing not matching the final product.
Okay.
I will say I saw the TV Glow delivers more on the horror of its premise in that there is a supernatural break from reality in the movie itself. And, you know, the bigger budget after World's Fair definitely frees them up to do more psychedelic, surreal breaks from reality than World's Fair, you know, which was mostly filmed, it looked like, on actual people's laptops. The supernatural part of it. In this movie, Justice Smith plays this person who's obsessed with a TV show that's marketed to girls, and he's afraid of letting anyone know about that interest because, you know, he has a homophobic father who he thinks will like lash out against him, but also there's this inkling inside of himself that maybe he's a trans woman, but he's like afraid to come out to himself. And watching the show both entices him to, you know, face that part of himself, but also ignores the dysphoria that it induces. Like, he's like both attracted and repelled by it. And a lot of it hinges on his relationship with this older girl at school who sneaks recorded, you know, VHS episodes of the movie, of the TV show, to him every week so he can keep up with it and they can kind of discuss the show. And reality blends with the TV show, which has kind of a 90s Nickelodeon vibe. It's very like Adventures of Pete and Pete and Are You Afraid of the Dark, that kind of thing.
Nice.
So that stuff has almost like a Brigsby Bear, like Tim and Eric quality to it. Like it's like recreations of this like outdated aesthetic, but it's very lovingly done, even when it is goofy. And then the way that media obsession breaks out of the movie to invade his real life as he's ignoring this part of himself that could completely change who he is because he's just too scared to deal with it. I actually found really affecting. Like, this movie put me in a really bad mood the same way that like World's Fair did. Like, it's a very sad movie about isolation and particularly in this case about like purposefully ignoring your body, your identity, your community, and just like not dealing with any of that to instead just sort of like disappear into media. And I found that like super affecting to watch in a environment where I saw 13 movies in 4 days. You know, I was like ignoring my bodily and social needs to like instead just like cram my schedule with as many movies as possible. I don't know. The themes of it really hit hard. And then I turned around and saw Abigail the same night, the new ballerina vampire movie that also has Dan Stevens in it.
Oh, right. Okay.
And I absolutely hated the experience of that. And I could not tell how much of it was like me just being in a really sour mood because I saw the TV Glow like really bummed me out, or just like that movie actually being bad. I don't know which one it was.
It was probably both.
Maybe a little both.
But that's funny that you're bummed out, but you also felt it was like so far the best feature you've seen this year.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a drama, you know, it's not supposed to leave you with a good feeling. I'd say there is like a positivity to it in that it's a cautionary tale and you can kind of feel Schoenbrunn like reaching through the screen to shake people awake, like especially people who won't come out as trans or like afraid and kind of stay in the closet. It's like, there's still time. You can do this. Like, don't turned into this guy. And his journey, as he ignores it, becomes more and more like Beau is Afraid style, just like sinking into his own anxiety and depression. And like his life becomes almost cartoonishly awful the more he ignores the central issue that's like eating him alive inside.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's like gutting, you know, it's like very emotional and sad. It's not like it put me in a bad mood because I was like unimpressed or something. It was more like it worked almost too well and made me reflect on my own life more than I expected it to, you know?
Wow. No, I'm really excited and I'm anticipating this big time. So I really hope it lives up to all that positive. Well, you were bummed out by it, but positive reactions is what I'm saying, you know, like in terms of the quality. Yeah.
And I guess I should note about Abigail, like, because it is out in theaters this weekend. I just like, I saw that trailer so many times with that little girl in the tutu, turns out to be a vampire and is like ripping throats in this house. And it's like, all that stuff happens in the second hour of the movie. Mm-hmm. And the first hour is just like her kidnappers hanging out while she naps. And you're just kind of waiting for all the stuff you were promised in the advertising to start. And I was just thinking, like, I'm at this festival where I've seen so many movies with like no budgets, like very small, minuscule budgets compared to this Universal horror movie.
Horror in quotes.
Yeah, it's like action horror comedy.
Oh, okay.
But, you know, so many things I had seen it overlook had so few resources, but just these huge imaginative ideas and like really swung for the fences and broke out of their limited scopes to like really tackle things about life on this earth and maybe life beyond this earth. And I think I saw the TV Glow is an excellent example of that. Just like small budget, big ideas, super affecting. And then to just like watch this, I want to say like Renfield style, like joke 'em up horror that like cashes in on the legacy of Universal's Monsters brand to just like make a popcorn seller for like wide audience consumption just felt so empty to me. So I don't know, maybe it was just the context of the festival where I was just not in the mood to watch that kind of like, you know, easy entertainment that kind of just like coasts on the likability of its main cast and the you know, gimmick of having a small child vampire in a tutu. I just felt very empty in the context of like this festival that was so full of like great art.
Yeah. What was that movie from last year with about the robot girl?
Oh, are you talking about Megan?
Megan. Yeah.
Yeah. I actually wrote that in my review that like, it seemed like they just wanted another Megan and they turned whatever this project was supposed to be. Cause it was pitched as a remake of Dracula's Daughter. And it very much is not. Like it seems like no matter what the first draft of this movie was, at some point early last year, some producer told them, like, you need to turn this into Megan. We need another Megan. Megan was a hit. And it has a lot of the same, like, TikTokable, like, dance scenes.
Yeah.
Which are what made Megan popular as well.
Yeah, isn't that crazy? That short-form video is, like...
It's driving content.
Clips over trailers, you know?
Yeah.
And that's interesting to me. I mean, hey, if it's going in that way for marketing, you know... Fuck it.
It's not just the marketing, though. It's like, because that is marketable, then they're like telling directors to make sure to include a dance scene. Like, it's like changing the art itself.
Yeah, that part I don't like, you know, is the interference of into the creativity of the filmmaker or the writer even. It reminds me of that episode of The Critic where Jay Sherman, the John Lovitz critic character, he goes to Hollywood to write a screenplay for the new Ghostbusters knockoff movie. And the producer character is like, hey, we're building a giant Duracell battery that's going to be voiced by Pat Morita. Write that into the screenplay. And he's like, no. They're like, okay, fine. But how do you feel about Patti LaBelle and baby wipes?
Yeah, this was that kind of corporate movie by committee thing where, like, I don't know, you could just tell there were a lot of hands in this. And as a result, it just doesn't have a lot of personality. But I am convinced that people who are watching it first weekend with friends, popcorn at like a, you know, a multiplex are going to have a much better time with it than I did at a festival full of like low budget movies with like much weirder ideas and like things I didn't expect to see because they haven't been marketed to death before I got to the theater.
This is an interesting thing. We keep, you know, I keep hearing this, you know, thing about, you know, popcorn movies, right? Where you go to the theater with a group of friends and you just eat popcorn and you kind of laugh a little bit, or maybe you get shocked a little bit. You're basically being entertained at the same time. Maybe you have a little conversation, or maybe you make a quip or two, you know, you're having fun with the movie. I don't see that too often anymore. Maybe it's only because I'm seeing films that I want to see, not just anything that's coming out any given weekend. You know, and I'm an adult, so now it's a little different. But I don't know. I mean, maybe it's the different kind of seating that we have. Not the balcony seating, but the big comfy seats. You know, it's no longer cramped. You're no longer stuck together where there's no leg room and there's no cup holder. It's just the armrests that are very hard plastic, and you're like right next to someone, you know?
I do think there is something about first weekend horror audiences in particular that are rowdier than most screenings I go to.
Okay.
Like that audience, it's younger, you know, it's a lot of like teenagers. It's people not taking the movie seriously, which can be frustrated if you're watching something like Hereditary, but can be fun if you're watching something like Night Swim, you know, like,
yeah.
Abigail is more on the Night Swim's end of that spectrum. But yeah, I don't know. It's just the wrong context to watch it in. And especially right after I saw the TV Glow, which was like a substantial work of art to just like turn around and watch that. And specifically a work of art about how I watch too much media by myself. You know, it's like, it's specifically making me think about, making me question some choices that immediately paid off in like the worst way right after.
Oh man. Yeah. And then you go see Abigail and it's like, this is,
what am I doing with my life? You
know? Well, maybe it is art, but it's just bad art.
Well, I normally wouldn't end on a like sour note like that. I normally would just stick to all the positives, but you know, it had to be said that that's the experience I had at the festival. If you want to read positive reviews, I mean, everything we discussed today and more, I'm sure, will be covered on swampflix.com and also at moviegoing.rocks.
Yep. I will be going over the really good stuff and maybe even some of the not so good stuff too that I caught. Overall, though, I really liked the festival just as much as you did.
Yeah, it's like some of the best programming in the city every year. I look forward to it.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And be sure to check out their affiliate festivals too, like Boston Underground Fest. That's a good one.